Hello and welcome to another Turkey Book Talk podcast. I'm William Armstrong. I write reviews every week for the Hürriyet Daily News. And in this podcast, I talk to authors about a newly released book on Turkey and its region. This week, I reviewed The Burden of Silence, Sabatay Sevi and the Evolution of Ottoman Turkish Dönmez by Cengiz Şişman, just published by Oxford University Press. The case of the Dönmez is one of the most intriguing subplots in Ottoman Turkish history. In the mid-17th century, the Ottoman Empire witnessed one of the biggest ever messianic movements when the Izmir-born Sabatay Sevi proclaimed himself to be the long-awaited Jewish Messiah. After his arrest, he shocked his tens of thousands of followers by converting to Islam in front of Ottoman Sultan Mehmet IV. Many of Sabatay's devotees also converted along with him, but most continued to secretly practice their rituals as a crypto-religious community into the next centuries. The Burden of Silence charts the course of the Dönmez from the 1600s to the present day. I reviewed it this week, and when I spoke to the author Cengiz Şişman, I started by asking about the conditions that allowed Sabatay Sevi to attract such a large following in the Ottoman Empire in the 17th century.
Okay, I mean, in the earlier chapters of my book, I was trying to again explain why the movement in the early modern times, like say in the 17th century, became such a widespread movement, not only in the Ottoman Empire, but almost across the whole known universe, which means that, you know, Europe, Asia, Africa, and also, of course, in the Middle East. I thought that as a historian, it was a religious movement, but it was also a social, historical movement. Therefore, it needs to be, you know, put it in the larger context of, you know, Ottoman Empire and then a larger Eurasian context. And I thought that, you know, as a social religious movement, which was one of the largest religious movements, by the way, in history, it has like various local and international reasons. And locally, I think Ottoman Jews were under some economic and social and political burdens and repressions. And I think that in Ottoman Jews mostly were attracted to the idea that, you know, someone, Messiah, of course, who had been waited for so long, was there. And then he was there to basically rescue them from sufferings, economic, political, and whatnot, sufferings. And that would be probably the number one reason in the Ottoman context. But internationally speaking, or globally speaking, this movement was not attracted by the Jews only, but also it was attracted by the Christians, and in part, small part though, by the Muslims too. And in the book, I argue that actually the movement was much more interesting and widespread in Europe among the Christian circles, because Christians in those years were waiting for coming of the second coming of Jesus. Sabatay Sevi, coming from East, from Jewish context, was thought that he was the anti-Christ for the Christians. And in the millenarian circles, millenarians means we have to probably explain it later, millenarians, Christians were the ones who were believing that the end of the time or the world was near, and Jesus was going to come soon. But before that, they believed that they need to see the Antichrist. And to them, Jewish Messiah coming from the Ottoman Empire was seen as an Antichrist, which means that it was a sign of the end of the time, and it was a sign for the second coming of Jesus. Therefore, I say in my book, the movement was much more interesting, or we created lots of commotions among the millenarian Christian circles in Europe than in Ottoman Empire. And if you combine these religious and political reasons together, you know, it attracted a great attention both in Europe and in the Ottoman Empire. And that's why in less than a year, it turned out to be one of the largest messianic, social, and religious movement in history.
And how many followers did?
That's a great question. If you look at the scholarship, I mean, there's a tendency to exaggerate the numbers up to like thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. Honestly, I don't believe that the number was not that high, but there is no really estimate, exact estimate of how many people would have or could have followed him. But for sure, we are talking about still tens of thousands of people.
Yeah, and he converted to Islam in front of the Ottoman Sultan Murad IV in Istanbul in 1666. And that was after he was expelled from Jerusalem, Izmir, and Salonika. How did his followers respond to this conversion, particularly in the years afterwards? His followers split into three main sects.
Could you
just give a kind of outline of what?
Okay, when the moment got so big, of course, that means that also it's a big disruption in social order in the Ottoman Empire. And at some point, of course, that was unbearable on the part of Ottoman authorities. And then they involved into the event. They meddled into the event because it is the norm in the Ottoman system that, minorities or Jews and Christians were free to conduct their religious social affairs within themselves as long as they do not harm the social order. But the moment they harm the social order, Ottoman authorities were allowed to get a medal or, intervene into the event. So they did the same because of the fact that there was a big commotion, disruption on societal orders. It was called fitne, in Ottoman parlance, meaning sedition. He was imprisoned and then trialed, and a long story. And finally, he was given a trial, actually not in Istanbul, but in Edirne Palace, because Mehmet IV, the Sultan of the time, in that period of time, he was in Edirne. So he was given a trial, and during the trial, he was given a choice of death or conversion, and he converted to Islam, obviously. And that was the point in which the mass movement turned to be a sectarian movement, because many believers outside, of course, were shocked by the fact that, he converted to Islam, since, the converted Messiah was a big oxymoronic thing for them, and many of them basically said that this is yet another fake or liar Messiah, and then they were disillusioned, went back to their normal routines of life. But a small group of people had the reasoning saying that look, if he was the Messiah, then whatever he did, it must have been right. There must have been some divine plan behind it. So therefore, they just followed the footsteps of the Messiah and they converted to Islam. But the number of that small group is very small, honestly, very, very small. And we don't know the exact number, but maybe a couple hundred people we're talking about. And that group of people was the nucleus of what came to be known as Dönmez in later centuries. Okay, so they formed a community, a small group, somewhat a secret group, and they develop a theology, what came to be known as the Dönme theology or Dönme Kabbalah, according to which they were supposed to believe whatever they believe, which was not necessarily Judaism, but a form of post-messianic mystical Judaism. They began to believe in that secretly, but outside they were Muslims. They continued to practice this secret religion for a while, hoping or believing that, their Messiah, by that time, of course, converted to Islam, was going to take them from that state of mind and bring the salvation. I mean, that was a typical expectation from a Messiah. But that didn't happen. Then Sabbatai died 10 years after the conversion. And after that point, majority of the believers, came to or went to Salonika, though there were also Dönmez in Istanbul, Edirne, and also Izmir. But majority of them basically gathered in Salonika and formed a much more organized society or community. But at that time, there were some issues within the community. The main issue was who was going to be the leader of this new community, basically, gathered around in Salonika. So around the issue of leadership, community started to divide. The first question was, again, who was going to be the leader? And second question, who was going to be an authentic leader? I mean, who deserved to be a leader? Who has the capacity or characteristics, divine characteristics, so that he could represent Sabbatai in his absence? So around the question of, again, leadership and authenticity, community was divided into first two and then three. And by the end of, by the actual beginning of 18th century, meaning by the like 1710 or 20, we had already three subgroups or subsects. All of them were called Dönme, of course, but these subgroups came to be known as Yakubis, Karakash, and the Kapancas. And up until now, that division among these communities, you know, continued.
And they were mostly living in Salonika, which was one of the most important economic centers in the Ottoman Empire. And the Dönmes were among the most important players in that Salonikan economy. Could you, I mean, what kind of work were they doing? You say at one point it was almost a Dönme city-state because they were so important, they held such significant roles. What did that involve?
Okay. Again, by the 19th century, now like it is already 200 years after the whole thing happened. Again, in the 17th and 18th century, they were there to develop their own societies, ideologies, rites and rituals and whatnot. But they were also one of the most organized groups in Salonika. They were mostly coming from very educated families. They were they had the skills of, say, Jews in terms of their connection to the world and also their connection to economy, and then their knowledge of economy was there. But in addition to this organized knowledge and experience, they also began to enjoy the rights that Turks would enjoy because they were on the paper or outside, they were Muslim. Therefore, they also, again, took a good advantage of being a Turk and Muslim. And they combined their experience and knowledge and also privileges together. And I think in a few centuries, they emerged as one of the most talented, educated, and organized group in Salonika. And beginning, since the beginning of the 19th century, by the 1820s and 30s and 40s, they were also the ones who had great connections with some economic networks in Europe and also in a global scale too, that, you know, they were able to go to, say, anywhere in Europe and even Latin America or Americas to do the business. And since they were one of the earliest globalized people in Salonika, they developed a sense of, like, you know, getting a good education too. And they send their children to Europe, for example, to get education. And because of, again, these globalization, education, and experience and privileges combined together, I think by the end of the 19th century in Salonika, they were one of the, like, the most efficient groups. Of course, I mean, Salonika was also a big town for the Jewish existence. Actually, it's the only town where number of the Jews is more than any other in any groups like Muslims and Christians. But Dönmes, despite the fact that their number was smaller than Jews in Salonika, they were much more, again, organized, educated, and also they had, like, more privileges, since, again, they could occupy, for example, all the government posts since they were Muslims. And those posts were mostly close to, say, Jews and Armenians or Greeks. And because of these things combined together at the end of the 19th century, I believe that, you know, Dönmes were the you know, the critical, central, and key elements in Salonika. That's why I call Salonika by the end of the 19th century as a Dönme city-state, since most of the, you know, the important government posts, including mayorships, for example, were executed by the Dönmes. If you look at the last five or even six Dönme, like Salonika mayors until 1912, when Salonika was taken by the Greeks, until then, last five, six Dönme, like mayors, were all Dönmes, for example.
And how did the other religious communities respond to the prominence of the Dhurmis?
Well, there were not like open reactions to them, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, there were some religious reactions coming from the Jews. I mean, we have some incidences showing that they were very critical of like the Dhurmis, but the criticism was about their like religious beliefs rather than the criticism about the fact that they were so prominent in economy and politics. Another development, of course, in the second half of the 19th century is that most of the communities in Salonika and also in many parts of the Ottoman Empire was that there was a great deal, there was a great amount of like modernization and liberalization. There was enough member of people from Muslim, Jewish, Christian communities that they were somewhat like emancipated, liberated believers. Therefore, religion stopped being an important element for them to identify the other people. So those liberated people, also among the Dhurmis too, had an easier time to communicate and to get along with. Actually, that can be seen more easily and more openly in the Masonic lodges in Salonika. As you know, the Masonic lodges were opened in Salonika for the first time, and their members were Turks or Muslims and Christians and Jews. I mean, they got to, all the Christians and Jews and Muslims and Dhurmis, of course, got together in those meetings. And then they did actually work together, and some of them actually became the member of Young Turks and also Ittihad ve Terakki Partisi, meaning CUP, Committee of Progress and Union too. So therefore, there were some reactions to them, but at the same time, on another level, there was a cooperation among liberated, emancipated Jews, Christians, Muslims, and Dhurmis.
I wanted to come on to that, actually, how the Dhurmis were prominent in the Young Turk movement. I mean, in some circles, it's quite well known, but it doesn't seem to be emphasized too often that the Dhurmis did have an almost disproportionately prominent role in the reform movements towards the end of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes, that's one of the, unfortunately, that idea was also fed into some of the conspiracy theories later on. But, if you take the conspiracy part out for the time being, there is also a point that, Dhurmis really played a prominent role in CUP and later on also during the establishment of Turkish Republic as well. But it would be wrong, to reduce the whole success or whole activities of CUP to the Dhurmis. As I said in my previous answer, there was a critical mass of people in Salonika already, and there among them there were Jews, Turks, Muslims, and the Christians and Dhurmis, and they were sharing the same, almost same mental universe, and those people were active in CUP not necessarily in order to realize their secret, agendas, Dhurmi, Jewish or Christian agendas, but rather we had a group of people who genuinely believed in some universal values in the 19th century and at the end of the 19th century, and those people were trying to realize those genuine aims, meaning to create a constitutional society, for example, or to create an enlightened society, to educate people along the line with modern ideas. And I think that, there were perhaps in Salonika more Dhurmis who believed in those ideals, but along or in addition to them, there were always other people coming from, Ottoman Jews, Ottoman Greeks, Ottoman Armenians, or Ottoman Muslims, who shared those ideals together. And that's why I think they did not hesitate to work together. It doesn't mean that some of them were deceived. Everyone knew, for example, who was Jewish, who was Dhurmi, who was Muslim. There was no almost secret. From today's vantage point, we think that people were kind of like stupid and some of them were deceived by others. But I don't believe that, you know, those people were naive to be deceived. I mean, they were not that naive. On the contrary, again, there was a shared common ideals which were mostly shaped by 19th century idealism, positivism, scientism, and, you know, modernism and whatnot, and then people just did work together. Among which, again, there were a good number of Donimas for sure.
Just to bring it up to date, there's thought to be around 60 to 70,000 of Donime descent in Turkey today, and perhaps 10,000 living elsewhere. And in the review, I say that the Donimes have actually quite a low profile in today's Turkey. Even in the many conspiracy theories that we've found, it seems like there's plenty of other groups that religious nationalists express more paranoia about. I wonder, what would you say the image of the Donmez in contemporary Turkey is?
You know, I mean, conspiracies, unfortunately, in Turkey, all the time, it sells a lot. I mean, these are the easiest theories most of the times, in many societies too. The easy and caricaturistic theories by which you could really manipulate masses all the time. And, you know, in Turkey, we have, in every given time, we have some big, like, you know, conspiracy theories about anything. And I think the Donmez, and in some other contexts, like, you know, Zionists, and then Masons, and then Europeans, or some other secret cabals, have always occupied the minds of Turks, and also, you know, the whole Muslims in other parts of the world as well. And Donmez played a role in different times, in different scales. I mean, back in 1920s, there was a discussion, a big debate about them. And then that discussion and debate, you know, was quelled, came to kind of like, you know, almost silence. And then similar debates emerged again in 1940s. And then we have another cycle of same discussions. And then it came, resurfaced again in 1960s. And finally, we had a big resurfacing of the Donme conspiracy in 1990s. And as of now, I think we don't see it much, but it doesn't mean that it's going to come back again, the whole conspiracy around Donmez and related stuff. So the reason I'm telling you is that, you know, there are always, like, you know, the different periods in which Turks, or the people who live in Turkey, created an enemy, and those enemies are either within or without, like from external or internal, coming from external or internally. Again, it's like, you know, to me, it's a very pathological way of thinking, but it serves a purpose to kind of, like, you know, unite people, manipulate people, and then, you know, show some directions, easy directions to them. And other than that, I mean, I think the main reason why especially Donme played a role in that context was that, you know, the conservative and lately Islamist ideology wanted to recreate itself, re-identify itself with new terms. And we know, you know, what has been happening in last, especially 15-20 years. So in that time period specifically, Donmez played a specific role of being other, an other which created a Turkey, or another which also helped to bring the coming down of the Ottoman Empire. So creating or imagining such an enemy served to this new rising Islamic identity in such a way that, again, they built their identity on this others, and others being here the Donmez, because to them, if they prove that, or if they believe that Ottoman Empire, which was so cherished, was again brought down by the Donmez, and also the Turkish Republic was mostly created by the Donme elite, therefore they thought that, you know, it would be critical to understand the almost anti-Islamic nature of the Turkish Republic, or radical secularism of Turkish Republic, so that they could undo some of the harms that that radical secularism had done to Turkey or Turkish culture, and they could create their identity through the criticism of this Dönme-related events in the early republic. I mean, in short, I know that it's a complicated story, but in short, I think that Dönmes, especially in the last decades, served a purpose on which Islamist ideology, created itself upon. For Islamist ideology, again, it served as an other of the Turkish Republic.
That was Cengiz Şişman. On my WordPress blog, you can find a link to my review of his book, The Burden of Silence, Sabahattin Çelebi and the Evolution of Ottoman Turkish Dönmes. There's also a link to an edited text of this interview at the Hürriyet Daily News. You can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, Podbean, or SoundCloud. And if you liked it, please do rate it on iTunes, which helps make it easier for other people to find the podcast. Meanwhile, until next time, thanks again for listening. Tellidir, tellim anam, tellidir, tellidir amam.